It's the 31st of May 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Are the English Defence League fascists, or do a number of members just tend to wave to each other in a very specific way with their right arm straight up? Will Amazon manage to shake up the fanfiction world without Kirk and Spock getting married becoming canon? Is the internet as free and equal as we think? And is a fecal transplant a case of eat shit or die? But before we begin, of course, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really do appreciate all donations, and they help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, we start the show this week with a history lesson. Over the last week, it's been easy to worry about the resurgence of the far right in Britain. Last Saturday, the EDL came to London to shout and grunt, advancing the brilliant strategy of fighting Islamic extremism by being drunk and abusive towards people. But are they actually fascists or Nazis? Or are they just twats? We start this week with a piece by Victoria Stiles, who has been helping us make that distinction.
Due to the increased prominence of the UK Independence Party after the latest council elections in England, and the actions of the British National Party and the EDL, that's the English Defence League, not English Disco Lovers, who were attempting to exploit people's shock and outrage at the murder of Lee Rigby in Woolwich last week, there has been a fair bit of discussion about whether Britain, or more specifically England, is facing an upsurge in fascism, similar to that seen elsewhere in Europe. Fascist, Nazi and racist are certainly useful labels to apply to anti-immigrant agitators and make for effective banners at counter-demonstrations. Kittens against fascism has been my favourite so far. But I've not seen very much recently about the origins of fascist and Nazi ideology, or the specific patterns of racism and white supremacist thinking that form part of the legacy of fascist regimes. Perhaps there is an assumption, born of the prominence of Hitler and World War II on the school curriculum, on dedicated history channels and in magazines and in popular culture, that everyone already knows all they need to about fascism and National Socialism, and that the ideology, like the people who cling to it, is really quite simple. As with all simple things, when you look at it closely, it gets really quite complicated. This isn't a topic that can be covered easily in 5 minutes or even 5 hours, and much of what I'm about to say would be disputed by other researchers and probably by myself the next time I talk about this, but I hope you'll bear with me as I go through the 3 points that strike me as most important and most interesting for the moment. The first point is the fact that fascism of old flourished, grew, gained massive popular support in spite of the many glaring contradictions within it and the ever-changing policies and opinions of its leaders. This, I think, was largely due to the strong appeal to emotions. People's fear and anger during an economic crisis were easily exploited as hardship emphasised every small injustice faced by people at the bottom of the heap. This hardship was contrasted with a supposed golden age, when the nation's true potential was being realised. That linked to the seductive idea that there is an untapped force which could make the country strong and effective again, if only someone, a strong leader, could break through all of this politically correct, over-feminised, elitist thinking. If we could just stop pandering to the conspiracy of forces trying to keep the country down, the left, internationalism, rampant capitalism and backwards religions demanding ever more rights. What we need is a leader who really speaks for the people, who has their best interests at heart, and who isn't a bland establishment politician, a straight-talking breath of fresh air. Hands up anyone who's heard that one down the pub recently. The second point I want to make is that far from openly demanding blind, unthinking loyalty to the cause and encouraging ignorance, information was presented to the public, in Nazi Germany in particular, in a spirit of opening people's minds, in a supposed anti-elitist movement towards public enlightenment. Public enlightenment being the other half of the name of the propaganda ministry in Germany. Reading was encouraged on a wide range of topics, particularly world history and geopolitical developments, and foreign texts were presented in full so that readers could, as was frequently said in introductions and on book jackets, make up their own minds. Of course, readers were also conditioned to read things in a way which would confirm the biases introduced by propaganda messages from elsewhere, leading to the kind of open-mindedness seen in conspiracy theorists throughout history, Reject all evidence from sources you already mistrust, while believing anything else on the flimsiest of proof. Still, accusations of stupidity or ignorance would not, and will not today, apply to all extremists. Some may mistake Brighton Pavilion for a mosque, but many will have an impressive knowledge of history and yet still believe that immigration is the source of all of their problems. In a connected point, point three, is the fact that racist anti-Semitic ideas were presented in Germany and in Italy, and I believe were genuinely felt by many, to be punching up against oppression, rather than punching down against a powerless minority. People were then, and are now, unlikely to self-identify as racists, not just because it would be bad PR, but because they believe their views are based in logic and facts, not prejudice. Very broadly speaking, racialist thinking in Europe in the early 20th century was about tying certain races to certain spaces, about peoples having naturally defined homelands within which borders they would naturally thrive. Only when people are mixed within the same area, so they thought, would you get a strict hierarchy of races. Of course, this was all thrown out of the window whenever it was more convenient to claim the absolute superiority of the Aryan race. But this idea that races could be equal when separate was a powerful aid to denial for people who wanted to seem not racist. To illustrate this point, here's a few words from Hitler himself speaking to an Indian journalist. Quote, Dr. Goebbels is quite right to say that it is incorrect to speak of races of lesser value. Unquote. And later on he continues, quote, The Jew is not inherently inferior within his own environment. But his outlook is not a good fit for the German people and can in fact be damaging. For that reason, the Jews must endeavour to live as a separate people. Each race must find within themselves their own world, and this is why we are quite right to defend ourselves against another race's attempts to force their peculiarities upon us, as the Jews have done in Germany. Unquote. There is little to choose between that statement and many similar things said about multiculturalism in Britain today. So, I hope it hasn't seemed like I've been downplaying the danger of extremist ideology, either past or modern. I'm firmly of the belief that understanding and explaining a point of view is not the same as justifying it. However, if we are to change people's minds, and in a fair, civilised society there's no other way of dealing with law-abiding extremists, then we need two things. A full understanding of their worldview, and some much bigger banners. This has been Victoria Stiles for The Pod Delusion.
Now, whilst we had some good news the other week on same-sex marriage, it wasn't so great for a proposal to allow humanist marriage, which was shot down by the Attorney General. Why is this? Well, maybe Dominic Grieve was just concerned about even more people wasting 10 grand in a single day on relatives that they don't ever see anyway. Or maybe it was something else. Here's Dawn Firth Godby here, yes, that is her real name, with more.
A couple of weeks ago, The Pod Delusion reported on the British Humanist Association's campaign to get the law changed to allow humanists the same rights as religious couples. Unlike the House of Commons vote last week to allow gay marriage in England and Wales, the proposed bill for humanists to have the same rights was unsuccessful. The result is puzzling, as the same-sex marriage bill was successful despite opposition of 161 MPs, while there was cross-party support for the humanist marriage bill, and it was only publicly opposed by the Church of England and Conservatives in the government. The Attorney General, who blocked the bill at the 11th hour, claimed that the discriminatory nature of the favour it gives to humanists as opposed to other secular organisations would have the consequence of making it incompatible with the convention rights. The Women and Equalities Minister, Maria Miller, also warned them against trying to shoehorn a new definition of marriage into a bill intended for the LGBT circumstances, and as a result, Labour were forced to withdraw the proposed bill without a vote. This all seems unfair and surprising, especially considering that the British Humanist Association also claims that the intervention of the Attorney General was not backed up with any evidence and included arguments that had not been previously made despite lengthy talks. And the Shadow Women and Equalities Minister, Kate Green, said it would be a reform that disadvantages no one. It costs the public purse close to zero, and in an age of equality it removes an unnecessary injustice based on religion or belief and it will strengthen the institution of marriage. The former Justice Minister, Crispin Blunt, found it glaringly obvious that humanists ought to be able to conduct marriage ceremonies. There has been a growth in popularity in humanist marriages in Scotland, where it has already been legally recognised since 2005, and where the number of marriages have already topped Catholic and Church of England marriages. Humanist marriages are also recognised in Australia, New Zealand, Ontario, Norway, Iceland and Ireland. As Isabel Russo, head of ceremonies at the BHA, states, "There is an obvious unfairness in a law which allows everyone to have a civil marriage, but allows only religious couples to have legal recognition for the ceremony based on their fundamental values and beliefs." So, are the government worried that since they have already allowed the same-sex marriage bill through, that, as Tony Baldry claimed, this might pave the way for other forms of marriage, such as pagan marriages or Jedi marriages? And what difference would it make if it did, if it doesn't harm anyone else, and what makes any religion any different to paganism? Tony Baldry might think that the idea of pagan or Jedi weddings is ridiculous, but are they any more ridiculous than any other religions to non-believers? Equal rights should apply to everyone, and that is something the opposing parties are missing. So should we be worried about the possibility that a particular ideology is being imposed on the public by a minority elite, since there is no clear explanation for the bill to be blocked? This is Dawn Firth Godber here for the Pod Delusion.
Now, at what point does an internship become slavery? And if you add one grain of sand at a time, at what point does the sand become a pile? I'm not sure about the first question, but I know an easy way to find out the second. Simply employ a recent graduate to work long hours counting sand for free and promise them not money, but work experience in return. But would this be fair? Alex Brown doesn't think so, and here he is explaining why.
In these dark days of economic turmoil, the issue of working for free rears its ugly head on a regular basis. Ideas from the government like the Big Society, having volunteers run their local libraries, the workfare programme, changes to the benefit system, and so on, mean that this is a tricky time to navigate through the worlds of paid work and volunteering. I'm going to take you through some examples along the scale, from what might be considered totally fine and harmless, right up to borderline slavery. As you can imagine, the grey areas are considerable. Let's start close to home. Contributors to the Pod Delusion aren't paid for their work. Yet week in and week out, listeners are asked, even begged, to make a donation. The money goes towards the running costs of producing and hosting the show. Now I know the editors are not making a huge amount of money off my back, so it's okay. I get a fun experience out of it, I get to learn how to do these recordings, and I know that if no one provided any content, there would be no show at all. Similarly, I make no money for writing my blog, which takes a few hours every week. But again, I do it because I enjoy it. It's useful practice for when I need to write other things, and I get to interact with interesting people through comments, sharing, and seeing what others write about similar ideas. But mostly, I think it's worth doing for its own sake. While I was a student, I also gave hundreds of hours to my students' union, gaining valuable skills along the way. You could even say that that experience landed me my current job, for which I'm very grateful. Many of my closest friends I met while out giving my time to raise money for various charities, or on the editorial team for the uni paper, running trips, even with my sports team, and so on and so forth. Also while I was a student, I did some volunteering for the at-Bristol Science Centre. Now in there, volunteering is usually asked for as a bolt-on kind of option, to provide extra activities for visitors during particularly busy times, like summer, February and October holidays. These activities are done under the supervision from paid staff, and they're never considered essential to the running of the centre. It really is a bonus to have volunteers come and do this extra work. I got a free lunch, travel expenses, and free visits whenever I like, for me and my friends. I always felt like my contribution was really valued, and I got a good thank you at the end of the day, as well as, frankly, quite a fun time in the process. Now, carrying on further along the scale, I also ran a stall for the Bath Taps into Science Festival during National Science and Engineering Week 2011. For this, I went forward to the organisers and said, I want to do some extra work for you guys, completely for free. I went along and found some volunteers, some of my friends and others I recruited through some networks I was in. I'm not just saying this all to blow my own horn. I'm in no means special in this respect. Lots of people are out there doing lots of different things for causes they care about. But the point is, it's for causes they care about, but also in their spare time. Volunteering, in many cases, is a luxury, something you do because you can afford to. Especially for students, giving time, not money, is the best way to make a difference to their society. But as you go up the scale, from occasional podcasts and occasional blog posts, through to more regularly turning up to events, you come out the other end in a far more abusive scenario. Let's have a look at an example I was sent just today. This is a UK charity advertising on a website called charityjob.co.uk. The programme's assistant intern will be conducting research for website copy, reports and new institutional proposals. The programme's assistant intern will liaise with the field teams in order to gather information for proposals. Support the trust fundraiser in researching prospective trust donors and drafting project reports. Proofread proposals and reports for institutional donors which may be in English and or French. The programme's assistant intern will be maintaining up-to-date information logs, for example, up-to-date lists and files of grants and funders, country-specific programme overviews, induction presentations, supporting data collection from the field offices, e.g. on direct and indirect beneficiary numbers and success stories, under the direction of the Monitoring, Evaluation and Learning Advisor, conducting travel administration, including organising visas and flights for staff and donors travelling to the field, coordination and ensuring a high quality of translated documents, and this is the real kicker, responding to other ad hoc requests from member of the programme's team and the London office as a whole. Frankly, this describes a real job. It's not a million miles from what many of the people I know actually do, full-time, properly paid. As for the requirements for this position, knowledge, skills and experience, master's degree in a relevant field, development, human rights, international law, anthropology, social work, demonstrable interests in child protection, development and conflict, fluency in spoken and written English and French is essential, strong analysis and research skills, highly organised, with strong administrative skills and the capacity to prioritise, high level of computer literacy, able to write clearly, concisely and persuasively, strong interpersonal skills and able to build and establish good relationships, able to work in a team and independently. This reads exactly like a description for a regular, full-time, fully paid job. But what will the intern gain from the role? As the advert continues. In-depth understanding of the issues. I can't go into too much detail or you'll guess who this is. Experience of working on donor research, proposals and reports. And experience remotely working with field teams. But no money. So you could say, well, that's all right, someone might want to share their skills that they happen to have, you know, on the side from their full-time job, it must be just occasional. Well, no. Duration and commitment? We need a minimum commitment of 6 months, starting ASAP. Ideally, we would like someone to commit to at least 3 days per week. So surely you could expect some kind of compensation for this amount of work. Well, travel and expenses. Travel expenses, London Zone 1 to 6, and lunch, £4 per day, will be reimbursed. Please note, this is a voluntary position, and hence unpaid. Now, £4 a day might just about get you a meal deal in a supermarket. Fair enough. And London Zone 1 to 6, I gather, is quite expensive. But still, you're expected to make up the rest of your time on 4 days a week. Now, if you have the kinds of skills to do this kind of job, surely you should be getting yourself a fully paid proper job somewhere else. But even given all that, you might say, well, I particularly care about this cause and I can afford to give up this much time. So you apply. And of course, most people will be unsuccessful. Most won't even be shortlisted for an interview. Do they get to know? Well, please note, we are a small charity with limited resources, and we will only respond to applicants who are shortlisted for interview. Now, small charities are fine, and having limited resources, well, that's a fact of the universe. But that doesn't excuse you from proper behaviour. I, for one, feel rather reluctant to contribute to this charity knowing that they don't treat their candidates properly. It's just common courtesy and good business practice to let people know when they have failed to get an interview. Let's not even get started on the idea that you might actually have to provide them with feedback. These ideas are just normal business. If you do recruitment, you have to tell people who are unsuccessful, and really you should tell them why as well. So we've gone through quite a scale here, from occasional one-off volunteering, providing a bit of content for a podcast or a blog, which has no huge measurable impact on the organisation that's getting it, right through to this last example, where frankly, someone should be being paid a proper wage. I appreciate the skills I've gained from the experience I've had as a volunteer. It got me my job, that I'm sure of. And I had fun along the way and met new people. That's all wonderful. I don't consider it an abuse of my time to do what I love for causes I believe in, but I also have the luxury of having a full-time job, and frankly not enough spare time to dedicate to the myriad activities I want to do as well. But it seems our society generally is confused about the role of volunteers. It'll be interesting to see how these issues develop over the next few years. With the financial crisis still biting, and both charities and other organisations looking to cut corners at every turn, the role of the volunteer may resemble more and more that of an unpaid slave. This has been Alex Brown, contributing as an unpaid volunteer and proud to do so, to the Pod Delusion.
Now, there's been big news this week in the fanfiction community. No, it wasn't finally confirmed that Paul McGann is definitely canon, but Amazon announced Kindle Worlds, an attempt to legitimise fans writing stories using characters from TV and literature, and then get a cut of the royalties on the Kindle store when their stories are sold. Sounds like a pretty good deal, doesn't it? Especially if Amazon can wangle it so the writers don't have to pay tax either. But will it go down well in the surprisingly large fanfiction community? To find out, I had a chat with Kate Keane and Tanya Brown, who are both fanfic writers and organisers of the fanfic track at the Nine Worlds Geek Con, which we featured on last week's show. The sound quality on this piece isn't the best, but stick with it. I started by asking them, for the uninitiated, what exactly is a fanfic?
Okay, a fanfic is a story which is written by a fan about an original text, the text that they're the fan of. There are a variety of fanfictions. There are stories which are based entirely in the world of the original text and expand or change the story in some way. But there are also a number of fandom tropes which use either the characters or the worlds or some feature of the story and perhaps put them in a different place or combine them with another original text. There's another type of story which we call an alternate universe, which tends to take characters, but it could take a world and put it somewhere else entirely. And that's usually a world that the writer knows very well.
So we're taking stuff like, say, Star Trek and taking the characters from that and writing our own stories.
Yes, we might put them into our modern day, for example.
And there's a whole sort of culture around fan fiction, which is build up. You've got these tropes and stuff. And this is what Amazon recently have announced. They've announced what they're calling Kindle Worlds, which I guess is an attempt to take fan fiction commercial. They've licensed certain intellectual properties, certain characters from the authors, and they want people to write stories and then put them on Kindle. What's your initial impression of their plan?
My initial impression is, oh my God, they finally discovered fan fiction and we make some money from it. While in some ways I applaud their initiative, though it's a bit late, in other ways I think they have such a narrow view of what fan fiction is and of how the community of fan fiction works.
Amazon have only licensed, I think, 8 or 9 properties to start with, and you can't interact, and there's a number of other restrictions, like you can't get too adult about it. Do you think this is actually going to lead to any creativity at all?
I think that within the fandoms they've licensed, which are all fandoms that tend to appeal to the teen, the fairly young market, I think that there are probably going to be people who will be only too happy to have other people reading their fan fiction and will happily comply with Amazon's rather vague rules about what they can include. For instance, no pornography, no crossovers with other worlds. So you wouldn't get, you know, I think one of the fandoms is Vampire Diaries. You wouldn't get a character from Vampire Diaries meeting an Anne Rice vampire. And they, Amazon also say that they're going to have some sort of quality control, and obviously that could also be.
I understand the fanfic world and the fanfic community already have quite a well-developed sort of ecosystem of websites and services that allow you to distribute fanfiction for free. Is Amazon even needed?
Just to sort of run through some of the existing ways that we have of sharing fanfic. I've been doing this for 10 years, and when we started out, we were using Yahoo email groups. Kind of following on from that, we moved over to LiveJournal, which is more of a blogging platform, but it works relatively well for sharing stories. And alongside that was an archive called fanfiction.net, which is a pretty big collection of stories in a number of different fandoms. They also have a restriction on pornography in a similar way to what we think Amazon are proposing, but Amazon have not really been clear enough about how they're going to define pornography. So fanfiction.net it's still going, and it's still used by some people, but any author who wants to write porn basically doesn't use it because they don't allow it. We see that as having a market for younger readers, but there are so many stories there, partly because it's got a long history, that it's become rather large and unwieldy, and the code is rather ancient, and it's seen as a bit of a repository for very bad writing, I have to say. But more recently, the Organisation for Transformative Works, which is a worldwide organisation which was formed basically to help defend fanfiction back in the bad old days when it was seen as a dirty little secret, and to investigate the legality and to help people who were being given cease and desist notices by various rights holders, has an archive called An Archive of Our Own. And that's a more up-to-date, modern way in which people can share fan fiction. Again, huge number of fandoms, huge number of users. I think it was around 350,000 users. They have relatively good search capabilities. There's a feedback mechanism, which is very, very important to fan fiction writers. Fanfic writers tend to measure themselves by comments and kudos, which is kind of equivalent to a Facebook like. On Archive of Our Own. And more recently still, fanfiction is allowed on a site called Wattpad, which also hosts original stories. So we've got a number of different archives out there. There are also archives, one I discovered recently is asianfanfics.com, which is purely for fanfic around Asian culture and is bigger than Archive of Our Own. And fandoms tend to also have their own archives, less so since the advent of Archive of Our Own, but there are still some out there that are alive and kicking.
Sorry, so it's a big network of people, but have there ever been any attempts like with Amazon to monetize fanfiction before? With the new Amazon plan, writers will get a cut of the royalties.
What we've really seen up to now is people publishing their fanfiction with the serial numbers filed off. That's how 50 Shades of Grey started. It was actually a Twilight fanfic, and the names were all changed, clearly in some cases using Find and Replace. Since that happened, I think the publishers have been on the lookout for the next big thing. There's been a lot of individual attempts to self-publish fanfiction, either with or without the serial numbers filed off. But as soon as you start to sell something that's a fanfiction without the serial numbers filed off, your legal position becomes rather more problematic, and the copyright holders are far more likely to come after you, and they're also more likely to win if they do. So I think that is the problem that Amazon have spotted and are attempting to address with Kindle Words.
What actually is the current legal status of this stuff? I mean, if people are writing and trying to sort of put out, say, a Kindle single on their own without using this Amazon Worlds mechanism of, I don't know, Henry Potter, say, would they get in trouble for that? Have the publishers been pursuing them, or is it sort of a blind, turning a blind eye?
It seems to be a lot less policed than it was, for instance, when I first started writing fan fiction about 10 years ago. At that point, authors were still saying, I don't want anything based on my characters, and I will get my lawyers to send you a letter. I think there were also some of the media fandoms were cracking down on fan videos, which is another form of fan fiction, really. The sort of, here is a popular song, here are scenes from the show illustrating the love between these two characters, this sort of thing. I think it's become a lot less problematic legally over the last 10 years. And I think now that the only people who get any trouble about it are the people who are advertising and selling work that is based on other people's intellectual property, basically.
That's all great. Yeah, and, of course, you two are curating the fanfiction track at Nine Worlds. What can we expect to see on it?
Okay. What we're trying to do is put together a whole weekend of discussions, presentations, talks, workshops about fan fiction in many forms. We've got a program item for fanfic for preteens, which is a market that, you know, a lot of fan fiction writers will say, oh, I started writing fanfic when I was 9 and I read a really good book. There doesn't seem to be a place for those writers to go, except perhaps fanfiction.net. We'll be talking about, you know, ways in which to cross over any two fandoms. So, you know, if you want your characters from Star Trek to meet Sherlock Holmes, what do you do? How do you make it happen? We've got a representative from the Organisation of Transformative Works coming to talk to us about how the OTW has been championing fanfic. That's a bad word, sorry. Yes, yeah, so multiple panels on multiple aspects.
Excellent. And we'll put links to find out more about Nine Worlds on the Podillusion website. We spoke to Luddy, the organiser, and Eric last week. We're going to be there as well. Kate and Tanya, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
And now it's time to talk about fecal transplants. Yes, that's right. There won't be any toilet humour here. That's right. Julie Gould has been speaking to the author Mary Roach all about them. She doesn't talk too much. It's not like she had any verbal diarrhoea. Here's Julie with more.
Health warning. If you're listening to this show whilst eating a meal, I would either advise you to turn off the show and finish your meal before coming back to the show, or put your meal to one side, as this might not agree with it. Once upon a time, on a cold wintry morning in Minnesota, Minneapolis, Matt
lumbered down the hallway of the hospital wearing a parka and these big boots, and he had this brown paper bag, and he handed it over and said, "Not my best work," which I liked. Yeah, it was a little smaller than they like. You know, people often think, oh, it's just a little sample, a swab or something. No, we're talking, it's a shitload of bacteria.
Literally. So I should probably introduce the story to you properly now. Mary Roach, who you just heard, is an author from California, and her latest book, Gulp, takes the reader on a rather icky journey down the alimentary canal. This particular part of her book explores a fecal transplant, which does what it says on the tin. You take the fecal matter, or poo, from one person and put it into another. Yes, I told you to put your meal to one side. And yes, it's probably not what you wanted to hear, but it's actually saving a rather large number of lives. So these fecal transplants are done to help people who suffer from a particular chronic microbial infection in their gut that makes them extremely uncomfortable. The invading microbe is called C. difficile, and it causes untold problems. So the best way to get rid of them is to empty your bowels and fill them back up with the gut microbes from a healthy person. Apparently, though, it's been done in animals and livestock on farms for a number of years, so we're a bit behind. Mary Roach will tell you more about how it works. Back to Matt from Minneapolis.
This guy hands it over, and then it's taken in a cooler. It's almost like an organ transplant. You know, you've got this cooler, and this guy is rushing across from the hospital to his lab to get the material ready. And really all that happens in that situation is he's under a fume hood.
For more than obvious reasons.
And he's got a blender.
Literally, your average bog standard, pun intended, kitchen blender.
It's an Oster blender. And actually, I called the Oster company to let them know they're the blender of choice for fecal transplants. And the woman wrote back, "Hi, Mary. After reaching out to our product development department, we've decided we don't wish to comment on this topic," which I think is sad. I think they need to own this, really. Some saline in the poop goes into the blender, and then it's sieved actually a couple times just to get the. It's just so it ends up like a brown liquid. It looks like coffee with low fat milk in it.
This is definitely not something you want to mistake for your morning coffee. Could you imagine?
And it's put in a container,
a very, very watertight container.
And it's put back in the cooler and taken over for transplantation into the patient.
Imagine the scene. You've mixed your poo and saline together, you've put it in a container, and you need to get it to the patient. And you're running as fast as you can with the donation in your cooler to get it there on time. It's a bit like an organ transplant. The bacteria and microbes in the poo are adapted to thrive in an anaerobic environment. This is one without any oxygen in it. So that is your gut. So no one is really sure how long these microbes last outside of your gut. As a result, your coffee-coloured donation needs to be treated as if it was taking part in an organ transplant and rushed to the patient in a cooler.
Who is waiting at the hospital, and it's done with a colonoscope, which is a device with which a doctor gives a patient a colonoscopy. It's the same, but it's got a little attachment with a plunger and you can put in some material.
This doesn't sound pleasant.
Within a couple of days, this patient was much, much better. He didn't have diarrhea anymore.
Hooray!
And it's got a 90-something percent cure rate for curing C. difficile infection, and it's now being tried with inflammatory bowel disease, obesity. There's a number of different medical situations that are in the process of being tested to see if that will help. The whole bacteria therapy is the other more polite word for fecal transplant. And that is, it's kind of an exciting field right now. There's lots of different projects. And I think also if someone's looking at oral bacteria and gum disease, because someone emailed me about an earwax transplant of sorts and cut an inadvertent earwax transplant, which helped somebody who had chronic ear infection. So,
well, this does shine a whole new light on the phrase exchanging bodily fluids.
Having an affair could be a form of bacteria therapy.
Oh, nice.
Boyfriend or whatever it is.
So there you have it, a beautiful story with a wonderful ending. This has been Julie Gould for The Pod Delusion.
You'd think with the box office success of films like Iron Man and the Avengers that the popular stereotype of the comic book nerd or the geek would be changing. But that doesn't actually seem to be the case, as Tom Hodson now explains.
I want to let you into a secret. I have a hobby that I enjoy, but it's the kind of hobby that a lot of people don't find appealing. And because of a certain social stigma, I have no interest in even understanding the concepts or understanding what it is I find fun about the hobby. There were a lot of hobbies like that. You can point out that Winston Churchill was a war gamer who wrote his own walls, or that a lot of scientists and engineers found the intricate fiddling of building models or scale train sets fun, but they automatically get considered anorak-raring geeks whose hobby is a substitute for social skills and are assumed to have no life outside their dank basements. They are demeaned as harmless but worthless outcasts from society to be mocked and considered at best bores or at worst the kind of people who deserve to be bullied. The lucky devils. I play role-playing games over my own adventures of games like Dungeons and Dragons, which meant that yes, at school and among a lot of the people that I've met, that makes me the kind of weird loner who should be mocked. If you see a role-playing game on TV, which is about the only exposure most people have to them, it is almost always as a joke with stereotypical geeks and nerds talking senseless rubbish about orcs, goblins and magic swords. And it's bad enough that after an episode of The Big Bang Theory or Buffy, I have to answer questions like, do you dress as elves or, and all that kind of thing. Like sci-fi fans, gamers are shown as being the kind of people who either can't tell or don't want to believe that the game is just a game, and long for it to be real. Science fiction fans go to conventions in costume and ask questions that don't matter about old Star Trek episodes, apparently. Trainiacs wear anoraks and get aroused by the right carriages. Oh, and gamers like me kill people. Wait. I've got ahead of myself. That is why Trekkies, Trilikes and Trainiacs are the lucky ones. They get accused of being boring. There was a time gamers were accused of being mentally unstable cultists, satanists, and black magicians who risked their life and soul by slinging dice. Yep, nobody thinks that Trainspotters have blood on their hands. In the past, I've bought games with warnings on the front pages that the demons, gods, and monsters of the post-nuclear apocalypse science fantasy setting, including psychic powers, giant robots, mutant dogmen, and vampires, were for entertainment purposes only and not intended to offend anyone who might have thought they were real. One of the earliest of a few mainstream films to feature role-playing games was about Tom Hanks thinking it was all real and descending into a psychotic episode. So you can see how the stereotypes are stuck about. Now, there was a Kickstarter project that seems to be a parody of these strange accusations about gamers, but this is likely to rekindle all of the old stereotypes and open old wounds. At the time of writing, with 23 days to go, a pledge to film a version of Dark Dungeons has over $9,000 of the $12,500 they need to adapt the comic. If the project is the parody it seems to be, then sure, it might make people laugh at how dumb the stereotypes of role players of the non-kinky kind and gamers are. But to poke fun at the stereotypes, you have to use it, and frankly, I'm sick to death of the way my hobby is seen by the rest of the world, especially if there is a risk of those who don't play games not seeing the jokers, oh man, look what those people thought role-playing games were like, but as, oh man, I can't believe somebody thought something as stupid as this game would convince anyone they had real powers. Don't get me wrong, I think that most people who happen to stumble upon Dark Dungeons will agree it is ridiculous and ripe for parody. It is hard to read the comic in which a girl commits suicide because her thief is killed by a trap in a way that doesn't seem to fit with any of the rules of Dungeons and Dragons, and another is invited to join a cult to learn to cast real spells when her character reaches a suitably high level, and not think that the resulting film will be a parody if it is intended to be one or not. But parody only works when you understand that everything in the comic, including, by the way, the Christian good guys saving the soul of the gamer through the Bible, is very far removed and outright insulting to all involved. Including, I assume, the vast majority of Christians who won't want to revel in the negative stereotypes of being unable to see the difference between fantasy role-playing games and reality. Few of the Christians I have ever met seem to like being tarred with the same brush as those who complained about Harry Potter books being dangerous, for example, and I should guess that the same old tarry brush is going to be waved around here. Let's look at something else nerdy for a moment. Even with Marvel Comics being incredibly popular in the cinema, with films based on the Avengers having their own adventures or teaming up, busting blocks, even with Batman being one of the most critically acclaimed film franchises of the decade, and the character being seen as proper and grown up in his own thrillers, even with the astounding popularity of Batmania back when I was at school in the 80s, how do you think most people react today when I read a comic book? How have comic book stores been treated on TV shows in recent years, even as Kick-Ass became a core celeb? Yeah, if you see a comic book on TV, it is not populated by the kind of people who liked Avengers Assembled in the cinema. It's populated by lurkers in the basements, clones of Screech, the kids who got bullied at school grown up and wearing ill-fitting t-shirts and sweatpants. Even as liking Iron Man is not just socially acceptable but pretty much the norm, the stereotype remains. That is with the best possible results coming from the films, and one of the characters on screen being a Captain America comic book, or at least trading card, fan, with his fandom portrayed as a positive aspect in the Avengers. That is with people gasping, not Agent Coulson, in the cinema. So I'm not convinced that revisiting Dark Dungeons, even with noble intentions, is a good idea. I wish the project well, and I certainly look forward to seeing it. It's the kind of parody I'm going to enjoy watching. But can I help but thinking this may add to the negative stereotypes and parodies easily as much as any good that shining the light of laughter at such subjects will do. Perhaps some old relics are best left buried and lost in the mists of time. This has been Tom Hodden for The Pod Delusion.
Now, one last thing before we go. Wait. I know I'm not James. Our last piece is actually by James, and he can't really introduce himself now, can he? Now, we're not going all postmodern, but he does talk about hegemony and Twitter. Here's James with more.
The internet has hugely changed the debate over free speech in the world. Now that everybody is connected, the ability to speak openly and offensively to a wide audience has never been quite so easy. This is why it looks amusingly quaint when you see Theresa May attempting to sound tough by threatening to ban hate preachers from the TV. She may as well just ban Anjum Chowdhury from selling VHS tapes or writing jokes on the back of penguin bars while she's at it, because, you know, the internet exists. Without doubt, the internet is a great free speech utopia, but a couple of different things in the past few weeks has made me wonder if there are actually caveats to the freedom that the internet grants us. First off, at Cory Doctorow's Sense About Science lecture that we covered on last week's show, Doctorow spoke about, amongst many other things, about how we should aim to have open and transparent technological standards, so that companies like Apple can't restrict what we can do with the devices that we own. For example, if you own an iPhone, all of the apps have to go through Apple's App Store approval process, which, given Apple's market share, could create potential free speech issues as Apple become the gatekeepers to content. In fact, it's already happening, as they've banned a game someone made showing what it's like working in China in an iPhone factory. In protest at this, Doctorow explained in the lecture he gave that his computer runs Ubuntu, an open source operating system, which is great, but it leaves me wondering if this sort of approach is actually workable on a wider scale. Whilst Ubuntu is a workable solution for a desktop operating system, as after all it can load up a web browser and check your emails, what about on communication platforms where there's virtually hegemonic power? What do I mean by this? Well, take a look at the equally closed and locked down platforms of Facebook and Skype. Wanting to use free and open software is all well and good, but ultimately if I want to call my parents, I've got to use Skype, because that's what they know how to use. And if I want any sort of social life, I need to use Facebook, because that's where my actual friends are. Whilst I could set up my own website in this internet free speech utopia, listing my status updates on what I'm doing and what I'm eating and so on, I'm not arrogant enough to assume that my friends are going to go out of their way to find me. It's the same with Twitter. If you're not on Twitter, you're essentially dead to me, as that's where I talk with friends, organise my life, and compete with other strangers to see who can sound the angriest about whatever it is the Daily Mail are publishing on any given day. And yes, in this internet free speech utopia, the likes of Facebook and Twitter and Skype don't have a monopoly on the publishing of speech, they certainly have some degree of hegemony. The word hegemony in the international system is used to describe the circumstances when one state in history is so powerful that they're essentially in charge, or whatever they say goes, even if they don't directly control the whole world. For example, the Roman Empire was the hegemonic power in Europe when it was at its largest extent, and the British Empire was the hegemonic power during the late 19th century. And scholars these days tend to broadly agree that America is playing that role today, for the time being anyway. If a country doesn't cooperate with America, it becomes a pariah and unable to operate effectively in the international system. It's the same on the internet. Like the international system, its components exist in a state of anarchy with no overall central authority. There's no world government and no organisation in charge of the internet, basically. But if I don't want to play ball with the big players like Google and Facebook and Skype and Twitter and so on, or crucially, if those services don't want to let me post my content, life becomes very difficult if you want to, well, you know, talk to and interact with people. So it's not about the individual components, but it's about the network. And if this is tightly controlled, there's not a lot you can do. And things are arguably getting worse. Twitter is becoming increasingly closed as they've recently updated their API, which is a way for developers to build apps that interact with Twitter, and they've made it more restrictive and made the licensing terms better favour the company. And just this last week, Google have abandoned the open XMPP protocol for Google Talk, and instead are using their own proprietary version. This means that soon it won't be possible to use third-party apps to connect to Google Talk, and you'll have to use Google-approved software to do so. So, hopefully you see my point. If you accept my argument that the internet isn't a network of equals where free speech is equal and everyone's on an equal footing, where everyone has equal access, then what are the implications on this to speak freely? Basically, I'm not so sure. Last week, Facebook caved in under pressure from a campaign by various feminist groups to take down some horrible groups on their platform that were talking about rape. I don't need to go into the details, suffice to say it was rather unpleasant. And right now there's a petition being circulated online encouraging Apple to ban an app from the App Store that promotes curing homosexuality. And this is theoretically great if you agree with it. I'm all for sticking it to the homophobes and the misogynists and all that. But what about the age-old free speech argument about would you still support stuff like this if it was your views being shut down by the mob? What if religious groups didn't like a Facebook group showing clips of Richard Dawkins slagging off religion and got that shut down? If speech like this was banned on Facebook and Twitter and so on, would this be a de facto act of censorship? Sure, we can post these clips of Richard Dawkins or whatever on other websites. We could even post in entire capitals with horrible background images and spinning animated GIFs to give it the full Illuminati nut effect. But no one is going to see that unless I share it where people actually are. And if Facebook and Twitter don't let me, then I can't. So are these platforms the new gatekeepers of what we're allowed to say? Or am I worrying over nothing, given that the internet is infinitely large and that there are no physical barriers from accessing crazy and dangerous ideas? Why not let me know what you think via Twitter or Facebook? This has been James O'Malley, bizarrely enough, for The Pod Delusion. And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 3.5 years of podcast archives. Also on our website, you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook, if you're into those sorts of things. Also, whilst you're there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All the donations help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Victoria Stiles, Keir Liddle, Dawn Firth Godbehere, Alex Brown, Julie Gould, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch in a Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Sick of you and your scummy radical Muslim ideas. What have you got to say for yourselves, eh?
Do you fancy a brew?
You make us sick with your Islam. Do we what?
A brew, you know. Do you fancy a cuppa?
Well, I,
We got biscuits.
Well, what sort of biscuits? I bet they're foreign fundamentalist muck.
Oh, well, we've got bourbons, custard creams, oh, and hobnobs.
Well, do you know what? I do like an hobnob.
Who doesn't? Do you all take sugars?
Two in each, please, except Leanne. She's got her sweeteners.
Righto. I'll bring them right over.
Oh, smashing. Well, we'll meet you halfway.
Here you go.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I was spitting feathers. Hey, who'd have thought it? Sunshine on a bank holiday weekend.
Yeah, I know. We're going to make the most of it, I think, you know. We're playing a game of five-a-side round back at Mosque. You don't fancy a game, do you?
Oh, I'd love to. Do you know, it's just like that thing in the First World War where the Germans and the Allies played football in trenches.
Yeah, I guess it is, yeah. So, which one of us is the Germans, then?
Yeah, do you know, I don't think we'll touch on that one right now.
Come on, then. Let's have a game. Or do you have other things to be doing?
No. Well, between you and me, us Yorkshire EDL are going off to give the Lancashire branch of the EDL a damn good kicking. Shower of red rose pillocks that they are.
Oh, they make us sick and all, they do. With all their, it's bitter on our side at Pennines. You know, I got half a mind to join you.
Hey, do you know, well, that's lucky, because In the EDL, half a mind's all you need. You're in.
Hey!